Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. Today we're joined by Christopher Thornburg. He is the founding partner of Beacon Economics. Dr. Thornburg is an expert in the study of regional economies, real estate dynamics, labor markets, and business forecasting. Prior to launching Beacon, he worked with the UCLA Anderson Forecast, where he regularly authored the outlooks for California, LA, and East Bay. Dr. Thornburg lectures on a regular basis and continues to teach in the MBA program in the new Ratty School of Business at UCSD. Dr. Thornburg, we welcome you.
Good to be here, sir.
A few months ago, we talked. I read in the news, Citigroup CEO Charles Prince steps down. Merrill Lynch's Stan O'Neill steps down. Freddie Mac issues a warning today, maybe a $5 billion loss. Is it fair to say the finance world has been surprised by what's occurred?
I guess you could call it surprise. We've seen some interesting times on Wall Street. These guys got themselves involved in some trades, and that turned out to be really unwise in hindsight. And of course, that's all blowing up right now. Are they surprised? That's a different question altogether. Surprise indicates that this was somehow or other unexpected, and I don't know how it could be unexpected, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, you know, bankers are generally viewed as conservative decision makers. So what happened?
Well, first of all, these aren't bankers. These are investment bankers.
Okay.
That are making the decisions. You know, you think about past real estate cycles. Past real estate markets have been driven pretty much by consumer sentiment regarding housing and limited on the basis of the bank, because the bank had really two choices. When a bank gives a home buyer a mortgage, they keep it on their books or they package it up and sell it off to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, given some very stringent conditions regarding price of the home and the amount of the mortgage relative to the person's income, the so-called 35% rule. Within that context, you know, there would come a point in the cycle where prices relative to incomes reached a point where banks were simply either not able to, of course, roll that mortgage over to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because it would be out of that 35% rule range, or equivalently, it would be a circumstance in which they were just not willing to hold that risk on their books.
Correct.
And that was the end of past real estate bubbles. This time around, completely different kind of market, completely different kind of situation. This time around, what we had was this mortgage, a secondary mortgage-backed security market that was a commission machine for Wall Street, where you had banks now willing to lend money to pretty much anybody, mortgage brokers willing to lend money to pretty much anybody because of the fact that they could turn around and sell it to an investment bank who would then turn around and sell it to whatever, pension funds and anything else, because so much of this stuff was simply rated AAA paper, regardless of the actual underlying risk. So as a result of that, this thing had more legs than any real estate cycle ever before.
The ratings have just been cut, probably will be cut more. Fitch is one of the rating agencies talking about cutting the ratings of collateralized debt obligations.
Yes.
What's the impact of when they cut the ratings of those CDOs?
Well, yeah, I should say that the amount of cutting they've done so far has been so minuscule relative to the amount of this paper floating around out there. And really, you know, they're scrambling as well. Again, they got caught up in the commission machine. The Fitch, S&P, Moody's, a very strange revenue system. They get paid by the bond issuer, not the bond buyer, mind you, but the bond issuer, to rate how safe those bonds are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you get a AAA rating, that's supposed to mean that there's like a 1 in 1 million or 1 in 10,000 chance of you actually losing some portion of your capital. I mean, they're supposed to be that safe.
Right.
There's only
nine companies in the whole country in 2005 that got that rating.
I know, exactly. And how many of these bonds got that rating?
Most of them.
Most of them. Top 85% of the tranches on these things got that kind of rating. Now, of course, they're unrating them and going, oh, I guess this is riskier than we thought. Well, no, it doesn't work that way. It's your initial rating that's supposed to take into account the risk.
Exactly.
Not a post rating. mean, price. You know, if you want to re-rate it as time goes on, that's well, that, we call that a price. We don't need a rating.
Well, you know, these so. Bond insurance industry that guaranteed more than $1 trillion worth of these CDOs. What happens if the bond company goes BK?
Well, exactly. That insurance disappears, and suddenly the rating on that bond it changes too. So you're already starting to get into the different permutations of this. You know, where does this go? How deep can this get? Well, let's say they start downgrading bonds that are held in pension funds.
Exactly.
A pension fund has a very specific risk level that they're allowed to take. So you have lots of the big funds that picked up these mortgage-backed securities over the last couple of years because they have looked like, at least on the surface, very good investments. And as they look like good investments, they bought more and more. Everybody completely ignored the fact that prices relative to income continue to rise at really at an unsustainable rate. And today, prices relative to incomes are ridiculously high. You know, prices are falling for no other reason other than they couldn't remain at this incredibly high level.
Well, in California, and I've seen the chart that you put together for the national numbers, California is up at about 10 times income.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I guess it depends on what part you look at. I like to look at the affordability numbers because okay. The affordability levels give me some sense of where we are. Let me throw some numbers at you. Let's take Los Angeles. In 1989, at the peak of the last bubble, the affordability rate was 80%. Now, what I mean by that, is that when you look at incomes for homeowners, not everybody, mind you, let's throw renters out of this mix. If you look at the income of a median homeowner and compare it to what they would actually need to earn in order to buy that home on a conforming mortgage, that is to say with a 35% rule in account, they were earning 80% of what they needed in order to buy that median home in Los Angeles at that affordability rate.
At the peak of the market last time.
At the peak of the market in 1989. In other words, you could say that incomes were a 25% too low given for prices at that particular point in time.
Okay.
That's pretty bad. Today, that affordability rate is, get ready for it, 60%.
Okay.
Your median homeowner earns 60% of what they would need to buy that median home in Los Angeles on the basis of that 35% rule. Well, that means incomes are two-thirds too low. And that's a lot.
That's a lot. So
that's a lot.
So you're expecting, I would think, a pretty big price correction.
I'm looking right now at probably 20 to 30% all said and done. And even that's conservative. I'm relying on a bit of resiliency there. The key price is at a certain level after they start to collapse. Now, usually how these markets work is they collapse, say, 25%, and then they sit there for a few years. And that sitting there for a few years allows incomes and inflation to kind of catch up with prices before they start to take off. And at the end of that flat part, there actually is often a period of time where prices are a little bit too low. Classic case of that late 90s Los Angeles, that affordability rate was 150%.
Correct. But the emotional side kicks in where you're afraid to do real estate anymore.
Right.
Okay. The super SIV, the $80 billion bailout fund, what's the likelihood of that coming to the rescue and making things all better?
Yeah, I like that. Well, you know, there's lots of things going on there. First of all, they have to raise money from somewhere to put this thing into place. And even though they're making all sorts of guarantees, you know, in the long run, you have to depend on the solvency of the big banks. And I think there's actually some nervousness about the solvency of the big banks. And so they may have trouble raising the money to do that particular bond fund. What's interesting here, of course, is, you know, I love the logic of this. What are they going to do? They're going to go out there and buy up assets with the idea in mind of supporting prices. Now, at the very top end of this, what you might argue is, that's the equivalent of me buying my house for myself for like $20 billion and then calling Bill Gates and saying, hey, I'm richer than you, all right?
But the neighborhood has a heck of a comp, though. That's
exactly.
Good.
You know, it's really kind of silly when you think about it.
What they're doing is creating comps for an asset.
By buying it from themselves.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Now, you could make another argument, which is that it's not so much about that as much as it is about trying to stem a panic-driven selling where the price of those assets drop below their fundamental value. But yet again, Do you trust these guys to decide what the fundamental value is? They weren't able to figure it out before. Why are they going to be able to figure it out now?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the second thing on this is you know, what degree, you know, do we, you know, so in other words, they're going to sit back and use their superior insight information in the context of a fire sale in order to cream skim off the best asset. Even that I find a little bit, shall we say, unscrupulous.
I wonder if we just don't have to take the medicine that we deserve and get to the other side of it. That would seem to be a painful but logical choice. Do you think that's likely to occur?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
In other words, we really messed up by putting people in these investments. There's going to be a lot of people lose money. There's going to be a lot of companies go out of business, and maybe that's what has to happen.
Oh, absolutely. But understand that the majority of pain we're going to feel in the U.S. economy is really going to be more to do with everything else that has to happen in the U.S. economy.
Okay.
And what I mean by that, of course, is the fact that you have consumers in the U.S. economy who've been spending far beyond their means.
Well,
you have a negative savings rate.
I love the new word that you've created, cash-tration.
I didn't create that.
Oh, okay.
I have to be perfectly clear. It just happened to be a perfect word that actually came from a Washington Post kind of a joke contest where people turn in words, they change a letter, and give it a new definition. So one of my other favorite ones, which is completely irrelevant to this, was intoxication. So intoxication with an A in there.
Mm-hmm.
And intoxication was the euphoria that you feel when you get your tax refund until you realize it was your money to begin with, right? Now, another one of the words was castration. So castration with a S-H as opposed to an S-T. And, of course, castration is becoming financially impotent upon buying a home. And that's exactly what I've been saying about the U.S. economy, that we're about to become a nation of castrated consumers. Now, I did make up one word. I don't know if you saw that later on in my presentation. But my word, I had to change two letters, but I also think it's very relevant for where we are today. And my word was home hallucination. And a home hallucination is the ability to convince oneself that while the price of everybody else's home is going to fall, your neighborhood is clearly different.
I hear that all the time.
Exactly. There's lots of home hallucination out there today, I got to tell you. And so, you know, that's yet again is a big worry for me, because there's lots of people out there who have managed to convince themselves that, you know, they're listening to the nonsense. Not in this price range, not in this neighborhood, not along the ocean, not with the mountain view. There is always some excuse while prices in this neighborhood won't fall. Unfortunately, the markets don't work that way.
Well, the number of foreclosures that we are about to experience is going to dwarf anything that we've ever experienced before.
Absolutely.
On a national basis, I know the number could be 1.5 to 2 million homes toward the end of 2008. Now, for the country, is that a big deal? Yeah, it is a big
deal. It's a real big deal.
Okay.
You know, a couple percent of all homes getting foreclosed on in the U.S. economy, that's not a big deal. That puts us back into the realm of the Great Depression in many ways. I mean, that's how big of a number that is. And, you know, it may actually go higher than that. You know, it's interesting. You brought up the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac reports this morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
That suddenly they're getting caught up in this. And this, yet again, goes back to all the nonsense we've been having to listen to over the last couple years. One of the big things is, oh, this is going to be constrained to the subprime markets, to the people with those risky Alt-A and subprime mortgages. No, that's not the case. It's much more complicated than that, or much simpler, depending on your point of view. When you get right down to it, remember, prices relative to incomes in so many markets, particularly in California, have never been this high. Well, that's going to work. That's going to be the same situation whether it's a conforming loan, a jumbo loan, or a subprime product. You still have prices relative to income way too high. Now, there's not too many of those conforming loans in California, but there's lots of. Don't forget that conforming limit works well for people in Ohio, works well for people in Pennsylvania. They're having problems too, because yet again, prices relative to income are very high. So, gee, what a surprise. Things are starting to blow up.
You know, one of the charts I had never seen before was the history of the Fannie Mae loan limit and the California median price.
Yeah.
It was almost exactly even all the way up until 2003, where we skewed.
Right.
I had never seen that before, but that's probably where we're headed back down to.
One way of looking at it, for sure. Certainly, you know, you got to have an affordability rate of, you know, something close to 35%, perhaps even 40% in the economy. If you want that kind of affordability rate, overall, you might be predicting price declines of 50%.
Well, these are the numbers that I just worked out over the weekend. These are the DataQuick numbers came out for the most recent quarter.
Right.
So this is notices of default filed in California, 72,751 default notices.
Yeah.
For 3 months. So if you divide that by three, you got about 24,000, okay? Then car, a total number of 25,830 new and resale homes were sold the same month. So you literally have almost a tie when you're looking at NODs and sales.
Right. Well, you two things you got to be thinking about there, though, is remember you're comparing apples and oranges. A lot of those notices of foreclosure, the homes haven't actually ended up on the market at this point in time.
That's correct. But that doesn't mean they're not coming.
But it is true, it's interesting what you said, because according to what I'm to understand, and I want to be cautious in citing this statistic because I'm not completely sure if it's right, but I've heard that something on the order of 25% of all sales in the state right now are in fact sales of foreclosed homes.
And next year, it by my math calculations, it'll be 50.
Very possibly.
Yeah.
Very possibly, maybe even more than that.
Well, we've never really dealt with that type of numbers before. But next year, I think we're going to. What's interesting, and I've heard other economists that I've interviewed talk about that having that many foreclosures is no big deal because we have 8 to 9 million residences in California. So how is having, say, 150,000 REOs going to affect the value of the 8 million?
Well, yet again, fire sales, people, you know, prices start getting reduced, and you know, that just basically quickens the process of the prices returning to a sustainable level.
Can these banks, do they have the option of just renting them out? I'm just curious if that's part of one of the options that they actually could choose to do.
They're going to have to.
I'm not sure I've ever seen it, but I wonder if they even have the option.
Right. I mean, the key point here is it, by definition, they have shied away from becoming a landlord. I mean, there was an article the other day in the newspaper about how there's a secondary impact of this meltdown, that is lots of people are getting booted out of the rental home. Because second homes are obviously are first and foremost getting beaten up, probably more so than the regular housing market.
Correct.
So yet again, from that perspective, the question is well, how long can that go down, particularly in a place like California, which is so rental unit constrained? Really, there's probably two possibilities here. Either the banks are just going to have such a flood that they're going to form internal units that can rent these products out, or else, you know, I could imagine this going to the point where the U.S. government steps in and starts buying up massive swaths of homes, because who else is going to buy the thing? That would be just a horrible scenario, but I mean, it wouldn't surprise me a bit. We're entering into an election year. It hasn't yet dominated political talk, but it will. And who knows what kind of crazy things they may end up doing in the context of this meltdown.
Do you expect rents to go up or down in the next couple of years, given the glut of homes that won't sell? If they become rentals, does that become more and more of a very competitive market where rents go down? Or because of the foreclosures being so high, people have to move into rentals and the rental go up?
Again, which way does it go?
I don't know.
You know, I don't know.
Okay.
You know, it really depends. I think it's going to be market by market. It depends on what's happening to those empty homes. It's so in flux. Again, I'm a forecaster.
Right.
And as a forecaster, I'm more or less a historian. I try to use the past to predict the future. We're living in a time where we're flying blind. I mean, there's nothing like this.
No past.
Sit back and compare. So, you know, in many ways, your guess is as good as mine on this front.
Okay. The banks say they're willing to assist delinquent homeowners, and yet the foreclosure numbers are out of control. So whatever they're doing isn't working. What could they do that they're not doing?
Well, I mean, they're talking that out of one side of their mouth because they want to sound like good guys, right? I mean, you know, what they say and what they do are not necessarily the same thing. So let's dispose of this idea of what they're saying they're doing, right? Because, you know, I'm not sure if I give that a lot of credence. You know, a classic case that is, you know, Mozilla saying he's going to go in and rewrite, you know, some, you know, 30,000 mortgages and give people different interest rates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, gee, you know, he can do that now because, after all, he sold most of his stock. He's just passing on the losses to the rest of his stockholders, right? So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, this guy leaves a trail of slime wherever he walks. It's phenomenal to me that he continues to run that company at this point in time, given the things he's done. Be that as it may, you know, you got to understand that the banks are in a very rough position right now, because as soon as you start changing the terms on some mortgages, everybody's going to want changes to their mortgages done. I mean, you know, they start saying, "Well, we're going to unilaterally slice off a few percent off your mortgage rate." I'm going to be calling my banker and going, "Hey, I want that too."
Right, that's what they call unintended consequence.
Exactly, but it's a perfectly predictable consequence.
Absolutely,
and that's really the big issue here. That's the big crux of this particular issue, is that those secondary incentive consequences are very worrisome for the banks. Now, it's not to say that the market won't get so bad that they'll have to change their tune. There may come a point in time where they really have to do something about this. But again, I don't think they want to do that individually. I think they're going to look to the federal government to set up some sort of process by this which this will occur.
I've heard the idea of a moratorium on foreclosures. Would that also have unintended consequences if, in fact, that got implemented?
Well, yeah, I'd stop paying my mortgage. How about you?
I don't know. Since I honestly don't have one, but I probably wouldn't. But I could see a lender looking at that going, well, wait a minute. If I cannot chase the asset in a declining market, that's not even thinkable.
Oh, yeah. You're just begging to make the situation worse.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't just get rid of. I mean, there's a reason that there's bankruptcy out there. I mean, and that is to say that, you know, we live in a society where we think that the creditor has some recourse.
Well, what's interesting is there is a bill in Congress right now trying to revamp the bankruptcy law that just got revamped, and what they're trying to do is get the bankruptcy judge to have the authority to not just request, but enforce the lender taking a recast on the loan.
Right.
And if the property value is less, or sorry, more, yeah, the property value less than the loan amount, they would make the remaining amount unsecured.
Oh, no, I would go the next step. I would argue that what they're talking about is not just, you know, writing down the mortgage to the value of the property, but actually writing it down to the point at which they think that the mortgage is now affordable for the person living in that home.
Well,
and what that means, of course, is that they will take a look at your wealth and your income and say, okay, well, you borrowed $600,000, and you borrowed the $600,000 by lying mm-hmm. on this mortgage application, but that's okay. What we're going to do is I'm going to unilaterally write down the value of this mortgage to something you can afford, say $200,000, and the bank takes the $400,000 loss. Now, that would reduce the negative incentive problems, in as much as you would have to show you have no other assets, your income's that low. But in other words, that wouldn't do me any good. It wouldn't do you any good, because presumably we have secondary assets that we would have to display in court, and that's the big issue on this whole thing.
Well,
that's the crux of the matter. So, but the financial laws, mind you, anybody who owns a home with no outside assets, well, everyone's going to declare bankruptcy immediately. Yet again, the incentive is there to do just that.
Okay. Well, Christopher, we have to wrap up this segment of our show. Thank you very much. It's always great to talk with you, and we'll be continuing on in the next segment. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week here on News Talk 590. KTIE.